南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。All right, folks. Hi, how are you? Glad you're here. Hope you're healthy. I want to continue this week with The Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines. And then as I started it on the Sunday after Sunday Gongyo, this coming Sunday, I hope to start the Diamond Sutra, which is Perfection of Wisdom also. You'll see what you will see. As I started to read this Sunday again, it's been a while, I realized how old Englishy the language is. And as you know, I'm always one to try to remove the authors or the translators or the culture's bias, because the words can be misleading because they inculcate their vernacular. But I think it's so obvious here that I'm going to read it as writ, and I'm going to leave it to you to pick out this constant Church of England kind of rhetoric where it says blessed or blessed and so on, and understand that what it's trying to mean is accomplishments, rewards, merits of sorts. But when again, the sports analogy comes to mind. If you do the work to become good at anything, not necessarily a sport, you achieve, there's that accomplishment thing, the blessings of your work. So blessing is really a crappy word to use here, because it's very, that's a religious thing. It's a whole other way of thinking. So, you know, I'll try to trap it as I read, but I want you to be able to discern this. Because as I read this, it'll become incredibly obvious that this isn't the right word. That the words or the words that would more closely associate with what the teaching is about is the development and the accomplishment of the steps toward something, toward perfection. We are dealing with perfection of wisdom here. It isn't about brain power. It isn't about IQ. It isn't about talent. All right? It's about adjusting and learning how the mind works, and thusly, how we perceive reality. Remember, we're samsaric beings. So this is a very important step for students who are wanting toward to being a bodhisattva, a great being. A bodhisattva is somebody who is on the path to Buddhahood. It's not Buddhahood, but it is the honing of one's perception toward achieving Buddhahood. Now, in the Lotus Sutra, we learn about what it is to attain Buddhahood. But way back, early on, bodhisattvas were discussed from the start, and certainly from the start of anything that would be considered Mahayana teaching, a really involved study and dissection, but it's there from the get-go. So this is the benefit of study, is that you begin to see these same themes investigated, albeit at different levels, which you might not perceive at first because you might, oh, they talk about the same thing here. But pay attention to how it's discussed. Right? We read sometimes in sutras about the 10 degrees or 10 stages of bodhisattva. That's because there's a word that you'll hear a lot, coursing in. It's a very specific word, because as I've pointed out many times, Buddhist cosmology, the perception of understanding how things actually are, moment to moment, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. Well, that's not an existence. You see? To manifest something, even these words I'm using, they're very terminal. Terminal not as in death, but terminal as in situated. Like a bus terminal. It's an end point and a beginning point, right? But in Buddhism, the tension on that is the point, because the point is ephemeral. The point is a mental made point. It is not a thing. It is simply an intersection of things. And Buddhism hammers this over and over and over again. And to become a living bodhisattva, somebody living each moment toward enlightenment, one must be living each ephemeral moment with this perceptive understanding that nothing exists. Everything is coursing. Everything is in momentum. It's in kinetics. See the words that I use? Kinetic energy, momentum, energy, traveling, accumulating, always moving. Nothing is static. The perception of stasis is samsara. It's attachment. It's hanging on to. It's possession. It's ownership. It's a self. It's a me. It's an I. It's a mine. All of those words exist on the perception that things have points that exist. But a point is not a thing. It's a location, right? And that is a moving location. It's never static. So to perceive everything that goes through the mind that way, our perception, as a moving, fluid, non-static thing, is the first thing to understand about preparing your mind for enlightenment. And in a nutshell, that's all of perfection of wisdom. So with that bit of knowledge going in, I'm going to go ahead and read through this. It's not very long, but it's a little bit tedious. And so I'm going to read it deliberately. And I left off on number 7 here, the wanderer Sunanika, in his gnosis of the truth, could find no basis. Though the skandhas had not been undone, just so the bodhisattva, when he comprehends the dharmas as he should, does not retire into blessed rest. In wisdom, then he dwells. So, again, archaic language, right? But the word wanderer, very important. The wanderer Sunanika. So who's Sunanika? He's a wanderer. Why is he a wanderer? Go back to the rhinoceros sutra. If you want to live like a bodhisattva, then don't be attached. Don't have a wife. Don't have a family. Wander like the rhinoceros. A rhinoceros is a creature that doesn't travel in packs. It doesn't travel. It doesn't make familial. The cow has offspring and she raises them and then they're off on their own. Rhinoceros is a creature that's very solitary. It doesn't, like I said, it doesn't herd. It doesn't travel in packs. It's solitary. And so this sutra, this homage, if you will, to the rhinoceros exhorts, and you can look that up on your own, the Rhinoceros Sutra. And there are many, many translations of that one. It's an early teaching telling, again, about how to let go of those things that seem to lock us down to a self, to a thing, a moment. We are always in movement. Like a shark, we cannot stop and ponder the roses. We can appreciate them as we move. If we don't move, we perish. And so the mental analogy of that is samsara versus enlightenment. Does that make sense? So the wanderer, now you know, is somebody trying to course in the method of non-attachment. Srinika, in his gnosis of the truth, in his perception of truth, could find no basis, though the skandhas had not been undone. Remember the skandhas? The senses, the perceptive senses, the consciousnesses. They're still with him. It could be a her. They're still with the bodhisattva. But it's the degree of attachment that this is about. Just so the bodhisattva, now he admits what a wanderer is, a bodhisattva, when he comprehends the dharmas as he should, in other words, the pathway, the rules, the teachings to get here are just as ephemeral and non-permanent as everything. It's just that he's given a shove to his birth death momentum to course through samsara with a different mind. That's what the dharmas are. That's why to call them teachings, it's kind of a samsaric term. And so we're communicating in samsaric terms. So yeah, we have to label it. But the label is excessive because it's really just a way of perceiving, and we've given it an influence, a nudge, through a teaching, a rule, a guidance. But once the guidance is taken, it no longer exists. It's affected momentum. Does that make sense? The only reason we have to repeat is because we keep sliding back into samsara. So you could see it as a bit of a tug of war of your bodhisattva path to Buddhahood versus everything that's like a rubber band pulls you back faster as soon as you start going backward into plop samsara. It does not retire into blessed rest. In other words, you can't say, I'm here and blessed rest. What are you supposed to, the accomplishment of Buddhahood, right? We can't rest there. We can't retire there because we're in samsara. So we're constantly pulled back. In wisdom, he dwells, understands what's happening to him. What is this wisdom? Whose and whence, he queries. What is this wisdom? What is this perfection of wisdom that would have me be able to retire in Bodhi and not get yanked back into samsara? Where does it come from? Whose wisdom is it? When did it begin? And then he finds that all these dharmas are entirely empty, which is what I was just describing. That doesn't mean they're meaningless. Don't confuse emptiness with value and worth. Uncowed and fearless in the face of that discovery, not far from Bodhi is that Bodhi being then. So this is the discovery of a wanderer who seeks the Bodhisattva way, who begins to live as a Bodhisattva when he finally understands, she understands. I hate this sex problem. Let's just stick to one, and we know it means all of us, right? Human. That once you understand that the teachings are an aid to redirect your perception and your mind, then do you start to awaken what's actually going on in your mind and your role in it, the you, right? This the seesaw of you, not you. And the fact that you have to negate something only instantiates it all the more. Samsara. Moving on. To course in the skandhas, right? To instantiate each moment through the consciousnesses and attachments of being in samsara, in form, in feeling, in perception, will, volition, and so on, the skandhas, and failed to consider them wisely. In other words, are you being dragged along by them, or are you perceiving them with a watchful eye of detachment? Or to imagine these skandhas as being empty, right? It's the same thing. If your mind is processing each of your urges and consciousness attachments as, but that's not real, but that's not, I don't need to let that affect me. Well, guess what? It's affecting you. It's the same thing. Being blindly led by your skandhas, or spending your time thinking about them not being real so that you're not led by them, you are still being led by them. Means to course in the sign. The track of non-production is ignored. Does that make sense? So, means to course in the sign. So, as I've tried to explain many times, the dual negation in almost everything you read in Buddhism of, we'll just go with the simple one, self, not self. You can spend all day meditating, all your life meditating, on what is not self. But that's a trap. Because the trap is that there's a signifier called self. And whether you immerse yourself, as we do in samsara, with self, and we measure everything we experience against self, that's me, that's not me, that could never be me, that's the me I want to be, that's all self, right? And then you train, you think you train your mind to realize that, but there is no self, there is no enduring self, right? I am just a traveling self through moment to moment, and so therefore what my self attaches to is not real. Well, you've just got fancy ways of describing yourself, as now you're a not self. Woo, congratulations. Because what's got you trapped is the signifier self. Whether it is or isn't is not even the issue. It's the fact that you're considering the issue that makes it so. Right? negation of something justifies that there is something. So yeah, the first early steps are realize that there's no enduring self. And you go, wow, I never considered that. But what does not being a self look like? Because I sure as hell am a self, right? So I can walk around all day long saying, and maybe to some degree you do let go of a lot of things that you had considered yourself. But by letting go, the very act of letting go says that there is something to let go of. So you're instantiating again. So what is it that's trying to be learned here, awakened here? So there's a third idea that says that you are in samsara, and in samsara, you are a collection of influences and influenced. You are a nexus. If you want to call that a self, then what the hell? But be aware that the signifier self is a construction of a great many things that we, as we grow in our lives, assemble constantly. Right? All these attachments and everything. So if you see yourself as a nexus of moving, never standing still, unattached existence in samsara, you begin to see more clearly that this idea, this nexus that we want to label and attach things to, is the initiation of our stress and anxiety. And so we have a choice. As our momentum carries us, do we course in the self delusion, or do we course in the annihilation of self-delusion, which is itself the same thing from a different angle, or do we course in this nexus of energies as a separate layer, a distanced, unattached layer of consciousness in samsara, so that we don't have an attached self, that we're detached, existing as an awareness and a perception, rather than being in it as a participant. It's a very difficult thing to wrap your head around, and the perfection of wisdom is all about that distinction. That's the first hurdle of a truly bodhisattva person working toward bodhi. And the most difficult thing to teach, to get people to learn, to self-develop. Because it's not something you can just bequeath and they repeat. They have to find it, you have to find it, we have to find it through our own insights, so that we can disassemble this miasm of self and perceive it. Once perceived, we can see it repeated endlessly in others. This is the beginning of Buddha's compassion. When we understand how difficult it is to break that perceptive samsaric reality, then we can truly understand why there's a sense of loss. People, all their suffering, all our suffering, all our anxieties, all our stress are based on this one thing. this accrual, this amalgam of energies, karma, that we construct this self constantly, moment to moment, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. That is the cycle. So how do we not course in that momentum? Let's go on. To course in the skandhas, in form and feeling and perception, will and so on, and fail to consider them wisely, or to imagine these skandhas as being empty, means to course in the sign. The track of non-production is ignored. The track of non-production is ignored. In other words, there is no self. There is no... It's like, remember in the movie Matrix, where the kid is bending the spoon? And he says to Neo, the important thing is not to think about bending the spoon, but that there is no spoon. It's a very interesting thing to say. It's a really kind of a Zen haiku, right? Or koan. It's a shift in perception. It's not a magic trick that says the spoon does not exist. It's the question of existence that's the problem. It doesn't go into it very much, but it's an interesting little pointer, right? So yes, the spoon exists. We're in samsara, it exists. We see the spoon, and now we want to bend the spoon. But if we realize that everything is a moment-to-moment perceptive reality, then the question doesn't become to bend or not to bend, or the thing or not the thing, the emptiness of the thing. All of those questions are stuck on the signifier spoon. Bending is a signifier. My effort to bend it is a signifier. All of those things are signifiers. So the trick of bending the spoon is an occupation, a preoccupation of a samsaric mind. And so the question of doing or not doing is an ephemeral thing. It's a mental construct. That's closer to the not spoon thing, but you wouldn't get that just from that short little dialogue. It sounds magical, right? May still sound magical, but hang in there. But when he does not course in form, in feeling or perception, in will or consciousness, but wanders without home, remaining unaware of coursing, firm in wisdom, his thoughts of non-production, then the best of all the calming trances cleaves to him. So, in will, but wanders without home. What does that mean? It's not talking about my address. He's not talking about this school. Think of home. In samsara, the home begins with this body, this self. I wear a suit, that's a home. Where do I dwell? The answer is in the word. We call homes, we call houses a dwelling. It's a place where we dwell, where we come to exist over time. See, time is a major, major issue in Buddhism. Picture yourself, your samsaric self, as this loci of points in a line, and that is dwelling. Right? Instantiation, there something arises, and then it dwells, it endures, and then it decays, and then it extinguishes. So a dwelling is truly a description of hanging on to birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, as though it were an extant thing, a permanent thing, a possession. But the mind, the true understanding of all phenomena, does not dwell . So to wander, to be a perceptive knowing experience without anchor, without dwelling, without home, is to be liberated from all such anchors, dwellings, endurance, stress, anxiety, right? You float through it, not of it. So it's interesting, the wording. You kind of have to take it apart, though. And then he says, and so if you can produce that perception, then you are understanding non-production. Production being the arising endurance, dwelling of all things, feelings, smells, home, and see them as ephemeral acknowledgments. Not even that, but words fail here, always. Then it compares this mental realization to a trance. I'm not sure that that's a great word for it, but that's what he means by the trance cleaves to him. To him. See, there's the self again. Words are a problem here. So this is a state of mind, of being, because we are through mind, right? So this is a state of being that is trance-like. Why is it trance-like? Because that's the only word in language that can even begin to conceive of a detachment, an objective perception. Make sense? Through that, the Bodhisattva now dwells tranquil in himself. So we flip that word around, dwelling. So now we're still a bodhisattva. We're not enlightened yet. So we're still dwelling, but we're dwelling in a place of non-production, of a samsaric being that is unencumbered. So words are a problem here. His future Buddhahood assured by antecedent Buddhas. So that's your only assurance. When you gain this perceptive place and you can hang on to it, then you are coursing through samsara with a bodhisattva, a honing, a perception, a perfection, if you will, of wisdom being perception, then you are assured to become a Buddha only by virtue of others who have come before you doing the same thing. And that whole sentence, I realize, is cyclical. Birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. But again, this is the difficulty of enlightenment within samsara. Because to leave samsara is to lose the opportunity to gain this insight. So this is the only place you can gain this insight, but realize how difficult it is, since you are manifest in a system by its very nature that instantiates constantly. So you need to be perceptively objective to the degree that you don't even perceive individuation, right? Not just others, but otherness, right? This book is other. The hairs on my face are other. But to not perceive that, to experience it as an actual thing, name and form, but rather view its process as distinct from your experience. To be an experience rather than a self-experiencing. Does that make sense? See, this distinguishment, it's a very, very sharp razor. Right? It's very different to feel like you're someone who has experienced something distinct and new, and then to take that last over the edge and not be a self who experiences something new, but simply becomes the experience. It's not an out of body, because that very sentence should clue you in that an out of body demands that there be a body to be out of. We're not doing that. That's a whole other mess. Okay. What we're trying to do is not to be out of a body. We're trying to be out of all body, planet included, while happily coursing in this body with that experience. See how different that is. Through that, the Bodhisattva now dwells tranquil in himself, his future Buddhahood assured by antecedent Buddhas. Whether absorbed in trance or whether outside it, he minds not. For of things as they are, he knows the essential original nature. Do you see? Coursing in samsara perceives now almost like an entertainment, a type of joy about the perception of non-attachment while playing amongst. Coursing thus, he courses in the wisdom of the Sugatas. And yet he does not apprehend the dharmas in which he courses, right? When you go play baseball with your friends or your kids or one another, and you throw the ball to one another, every time you throw the ball, you aren't thinking back to everything you've learned about a ball since you were a baby trying to put it in your mouth. Slowly you learned a lot of things about the ball, how to throw things, how to throw the ball, blah, 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 blah. You don't course in all of that in order each time to throw the ball. Right? So, he does not apprehend the dharmas in which he courses. You simply course. You simply move your momentum perceptively, experientially, without having to review every which way in which you finally got to that mental state. This coursing he wisely knows as no coursing. Because in order to course, you have to course through something. Once you course in non-production, there is no thing to course through, then you are just experience. No time. Coursing is time. time through time. This coursing he wisely knows as no coursing. That is his practice of wisdom, the highest perfection. So there it is. That is the perfection of wisdom. What exists not, that not existent, the foolish imagine, non-existence as well as existence they fashion, as dharmic facts existence and non-existence are both not real, a bodhisattva goes forth when wisely he knows this. So now we're repeating in different words what I've just been discussing. If he knows the five skandhas as like illusion, but makes not illusion one thing, and the skandhas another, if freed from the notion of multiple things he courses in peace, then that is his practice of wisdom, the highest perfection. Those with good teachers as well as deep insight cannot be frightened on hearing the mother's deep tenets. But those with bad teachers who can be misled by others are ruined thereby as an unbaked pot when in contact with moisture. Mold. What is the reason why we speak of bodhisattvas? Desirous to extinguish all attachment and to cut it off. True non-attachment, or the bodhi of the jhanas, is their future lot. Beings who strive for bodhi, are they therefore called? So a bodhisattva is someone who strives for Buddhahood. What is the reason why great beings are so called? They rise to the highest place above a great number of people, and of a great number of people they cut off mistaken views. That is why we come to speak of them as great beings. So you'll notice in many sutras, the great beings, bodhisattvas, those are interchangeable terms. Great as a giver, as a thinker, as a power, he mounts upon the vessel of the supreme jhanas. Armed with the great armor, he'll subdue Mara, the artful. Mara are earthly desires, earthly attachments, samsara. These are the reasons why great beings are so called. This gnosis shows him all beings as like an illusion. Resembling a great crowd of people conjured up at the crossroads by a magician who then cuts off many thousands of heads, he knows this whole living world as a mock show and yet remains without fear. Slowly with words, we're circling around this idea, right? Form, perception, feeling, will, and awareness are ununited, never bound, cannot be freed, because how can you free something that isn't there? Uncowed in his thought, he marches on to his bodhi, that for the highest of men is the best of all armors. What then again is the vessel that leads to the bodhi? Mounted upon it, one guides to nirvana all beings. Great is that vessel, immense, vast like the vastness of space. Those who travel upon it are carried to safety, delight, and ease. So again, all of these words are about removal from our state of attachment. Right? How are we doing? I wonder if I can finish this. If you'll indulge me. Thus transcending the world, he eludes our apprehensions. He goes to nirvana, but no one can say where he went to. A fire's extinguished, but where, do we ask, has it gone to? Likewise, how can we find him who has found the rest of the blessed? In other words, the rest of the accomplishment of this perfection of wisdom, or of Bodhi, because perfection of wisdom is the tool by which the Bodhisattva removes ourselves from this huge play of all phenomena of arising, dwelling, what's the other word I use? Decay and extinction. We rise above that, we transcend that to see it all in its amazing, it's glorious. Humans, grass, trees, oceans, weather, planes, cars, everything is this process. And we elevate our minds unattached to that process. We can then view the process as everything's a dandelion. Or not a dandelion. Or dandelionness is just something to observe. It's not actual. And yet I am actual in this samsaric life, perceiving the non-actuality of everything. That is an unglued, how can you refer to it? Trance, maybe. But I would argue trance is a very earthbound kind of samsaric kind of thing. Right? So like a fire. Why the allusion to fire and the fire going out? Where does the fire go to? The fire is samsara. The fire is this perception of self. That's why there's so much stress and anxiety about it. Right? How many times do we talk about the passions, the fire in people? We see them. All of us, quiet or loud, are fires burning, samsara. And so our perspective changes, our perception changes, our experience then is unattached. And when we do that, others don't perceive our passions, our fire. They perceive us as other because they're samsarically bound, but they can't quite describe why we're different, how we don't fit in their normal perception of things, people. So that's a nirvana of sorts. It's a nirvana of remainder because you're still here experiencing it. See, there are two different types of nirvana. I've talked about that before, and we'll talk about it again. But this is a nirvana of remainder. We're still here. We're continuing through our cycle of birth and death. It's like birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. But we're unattached to it. So it's going on, keeping our mental perceptive experience intact. The Bodhisattva's past, his future and present must elude us. Times three dimensions nowhere touch him. Times three directions nowhere, or dimensions nowhere touch him. There it is in clear print, time. Buddhahood is without time. To touch that without timeness while in time's grasp is bodhisattva. But we're not touched. We are not anchored to the dimensions of time, space. We are experiencing it without being attached to it or defined by it. It's a mental shift, right? Quite pure he is, free from conditions, unimpeded. That is his practice of wisdom and highest perfection. Wise bodhisattvas coursing thus reflect on non-production, and yet while doing so, engender themselves the great compassion. Why is that? I explained that earlier. Because to be here without being admired in it is to develop great compassion. Have you ever been in a situation? Boy, it would be hard to make this a universal example. Maybe you went to a foreign country. Maybe you went to a place, or maybe within your country, you found yourself in a place where maybe it was children, maybe it was, a foster home or I can't think of a good example. A condition where you were completely an observer, and there were just many, many examples of people going through dramatic struggle of some sort. And that struggle was so distant from your experience at that moment that the only thing you could feel is a sort of a pity and a wish you could do something, but you feel helpless. Or maybe not helpless, but a deep desire to either wake everybody up or redirect their energies, or gosh, if only. If you've ever been in that kind of situation, that's an attempt here at what, when you have this perfection of wisdom, you then see around you in samsara the vice grip of self and attachments and stress and anxiety that everything else, not coursing in the perfection of wisdom, you witness it much more viscerally, right? Because you know how hard it was for your own distance from it. Which is, however, free from any notion of being. Thereby, they practice wisdom, the highest perfection. But when the notion of suffering in beings leads them to think, suffering I shall remove, the wheel of the world I shall work, beings are then imagined, a self is imagined, the practice of wisdom, the highest perfection, is lacking. So to have compassion is not the same as diving in and helping. I'm going to get my hands dirty and I'm going to get these people out of this situation. Well, now you're a people. This whole thing is about getting you to understand that razor's edge, that line of distinction between plummeting right back into samsara or getting out of the pool. Really out of the pool. But when the notion of suffering in beings leads him to think, suffering I shall remove, the wheel of the world I shall work, beings are then imagined, and a self is imagined. So the compassion isn't about seeing individuals struggling with their struggles. It's about the nature of samsara being expanded before you. Not by selves, not by individuals, but as a process that is ongoing, that which you are not a part of. Seeing the distinction. He wisely knows that all that lives is unproduced as himself is. He knows that all that is no more exists than he or any beings. The unproduced and the produced are not distinguished. That is the practice of wisdom, the highest perfection. All words for things in use in this world must be left behind. All things produced and made must be transcended. The deathless, the supreme, incomparable gnosis is then one. That is the sense in which we speak of perfect wisdom. When free from doubts, the Bodhisattva carries on his practice, as skilled in wisdom as he is known to dwell. All dharmas are not really there. Their essential or original nature is empty. To comprehend that is the practice of wisdom, perfection supreme. All right, and I'm going to end on that. So, this first, should I call it chapter? Yeah. This first chapter of the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines basically lays out what the rest of this whole book, 8,000 Lines, is going to disassemble, take apart, investigate over and over again, each and every aspect of this. So, it may seem like we just covered a lot of ground. We really only talked about one thing, is what is this boundary between samsaric, student, disciple, monkhood, human endeavor of learning the Dharma? And at what point do we enter a path where, as a human in samsara, we are perceiving and perceived as somebody who is more what you might call in more modern terms a force of nature, somebody who seems to exist outside the realm of everyone else, this bodhisattva who is coursing through samsara with something else on his mind, on her mind, with something else achieved, and still desiring to achieve greater, complete bodhi, or even to have achieved Buddhahood and to course in the world as such, because that is the ultimate degree of bodhisattva. See, there's a range there. And that once one is completely within the realm of non-instantiation, while living in the cycle of birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, then one inspires immediately, or repels, or influences, but is not influenced, coursing in Buddhahood. One remains in samsara for the benefit of all others. That is the ultimate for our practice. Right? Like Nichiren, like Tendai, like Dengyo, like Shakyamuni. Right? So, a lot of words. Don't worry if you didn't get the light in the attic on this one. I'm sure you got some glimmers and maybe even a few lights. But again, we're dealing with language biases. We're dealing with a long program of teaching, right? Shakyamuni didn't show up in a classroom, give this lecture, and says there'll be a test on Monday, right? So we're going to read a heck of a lot more. And I think as I jump around with some of these other books, you're going to hear a lot of the same things. And at some point, through your own filters, your own experience of life, something's going to gel. And you're going, oh, I get it now. Of course, there's a lot of work after you get it and actually doing. But the more insights you get, the easier it will become to understand the nature of what you need to accomplish to get your reward, right? Thank you for listening. This is a lot of scholarship. Sometimes I worry that that makes this practice seem too hard. I don't want you to go away that way. Please know that in our capacity, in our era, you and I, simply to chant Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, to our mandala, to awaken that pathway, that Bodhi, what did he call it? That non-production, that perception of non-production, that's what we instantiate every time we chant the Daimoku. See, we have an immediate tool. We have a tool that opens that door right away for us. We may not know how to describe it, put words to it, or even to share it with others, other than to get them to chant with us. But we have the tool. So don't ever forget that. These are teachings that are thousands of years old and only beginning to get to that door, that doorway, that there is a door. So all the more to appreciate our practice of the Lotus Sutra, right? So always remember that. But I think it's fascinating that even these older, earlier teachings are, they're building blocks. And we can recognize the building blocks by the footprints they make to the amazing lotus. We just get deeper and deeper appreciation for all of this assumed knowledge that the Lotus Sutra has. And so we teach, we learn this other stuff, not because we want to diverge from the Lotus Sutra, right? But because whatever obstacles we may have in our practice as we chant Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, we may find clues to destroying certain groups of attachments and misperceptions by reading through these earlier texts, right? It's a human condition. So thanks for participating. Thank you so much for your support. I don't even know how to say how much I appreciate that. I am working on doing live broadcasts. There, I said it. But it's no small task with equipment and finances. And so I'm going to try to put some of the support that I'm getting aside into a special bin toward getting the connectivity and the equipment that I need to hook the school up to the internet so that it can support live streaming. Not just for Gangyo, although I think it'll be really amazing to do Gangyo with all your voices going simultaneously. I can't wait to see what that's like. But I think there'll be other opportunities that will grow from that. I just don't want to do it half-assed and then have us get a bad experience in our heads and say, well, I don't, you know, oh, he's doing one of those again. I don't need to want, I don't want that to happen. Your practice is paramount to me. So whatever I do, I want to do it at least a good enough level that I feel like I've done a good thing, a good basis for practice. Whether that turns into Q&As or not, I don't see this channel as your typical YouTube channel selling merch and promoting and all that. There's enough of that in the world. This is all about increasing our ability and our insights into practicing Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. So maybe I'll have a new idea by the time that becomes a reality here. But I'm working toward it, and just so you know. And in the meantime, I'll just keep doing this study program with you. We are growing, you know, slowly, but inch by inch, right? Anyway, thank you so much. Like, share, subscribe, all that stuff. And I'll see you in the next one. Take care of your health. Be kind. And bye-bye for now.